So coming up now, it's an interview with Simon Hart. He wrote the book World in Motion about the Italia 90 World Cup. Brilliant tournament, not so much on the pitch, but we'll get into that. This is the first part of the interview. We'll play out the second part next week because it's quite long. So here's the first part of that chat. All right, delighted to be joined by Simon Hart, author of World in Motion, the inside story of Italia 90, the tournament that changed football. Obviously, you've been on with us before. You wrote the book Everton in the 80s, and myself and Joe took time to chat to you. I think there was the one that bit that always jumps out to me is the Brain of Britain thing about Martin Keown and how he ended up kicking Kevin Sheedy in the head. But some great stories in that book. But obviously, we're in a World Cup year, and you met about 100 people all in all, in the making of this World Cup book, which takes us back to Italia 90. You're only 17 when this tournament happens. So you're kind of, I suppose, at that age where you're not completely cynical about the world and football, whereas I'm a one-year-old, and I'm kind of looking back at it from a massive remove.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And I think the big thing for me as a 17-year-old was just you had a month of football, you know, wall-to-wall football, which we just weren't used to, which is why a World Cup then was something so exciting. I worked out for the book that there'd been just 12 top-flight English League games televised that season leading up to the World Cup, just as a measure of, you know, how brilliant it was to have all this football and all these, you know, teams you don't know, all the players you don't know, because there was no live European Cup football either on the telly that year with the ban from the English team. So yeah, 17 years old, extremely excited, and really not expecting, you know, to see an England team go that far.
Yeah, because, okay, 1990, there's two schools of thought, so a dull tournament on one hand in terms of the football, the style of that, but then such a culturally significant one. Obviously, you've the Ireland story, which is still huge here. It's one of the most significant events, sporting or otherwise, that ever happened in this country. Then you have England, who have had the best World Cup since 66. Cameroon, who are just probably arguably the story of the tournament. Scalacci, Gaza, Nessun Dorma, and then you could go on and on and on. So where do you, like, in terms of balancing those two sides, so the dull football and the cultural significance, where do you kind of balance it out?
I think the quibbles about, you know, football style, it's extremely important in terms of its own impact, because you know, it led to rule changes which completely changed the way the game's played. You know, the back pass rule, professional foul leading to a red card, a change to the offside. Sepp Blatter was an instigator, really, in setting the wheels in motion for a more open, entertaining game. I don't think it was a moment in time where, certainly through my eyes at the time, you know, it was this huge spectacle on the television, and there were these brilliant players scoring, you know, exciting goals. So there were fewer goals. 2.2 was the average, was the lowest ever for a World Cup. But I think the strong narratives outweigh the negatives of that World Cup, at least with hindsight.
Yeah, and obviously the big stories, I suppose, to start off, Cameroon, as I said, would arguably be the story of the tournament. Now, it was their second World Cup. They'd been there in 82, and they'd actually gone through the 82 World Cup unbeaten. So maybe, and they'd won, I think, two African Nations Cups in between that time. So maybe it shouldn't have been as big a surprise when they land there and not just physically dominate the Argentinians, but actually beat them thanks to Francois Oman Biik's opener.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw Roger Miller, who I met at his home in Yaoundé in Cameroon, he did make that point. You know, it was more a question of European ignorance. It shouldn't have been a surprise that we were good. However, I mean, there's the historical context here. No team from sub-Saharan Africa had ever won a World Cup finals match.
Yeah.
So the fact that Cameroon turn up, and they don't just beat any old team, they beat Maradona and Argentina in the opening game, in the San Siro, you know, it was a sensation. And the way they did it, you know, the drama of him, Maradona's being booed by the Italian crowd. He's being booted around the pitch by the Cameroonian players, as is Caniggia.
Yeah.
Two red cards. So Cameroon are down to 9 men, and they still hold out against the world champions. I mean, it was a sensational start, and I know we've said about the quality of the football, but the sheer drama of the the big games in that tournament, you know, brilliant stories.
Yeah. Benjamin Massing was somebody who you met as well. Now, he sadly passed away. Now, in that World Cup, obviously, you mentioned the fouls and the slightly, well, it was the era anyway, so all around the world, like, it's completely different to the fouls we see now, which there's fewer fouls, but also the brutality of them have changed. Massing completely takes out Caniggia. It's quite a comical thing, as you write in the book, where it's almost, I suppose it's like those, you know, cartoons you watch where the person's just about escaping about two or three different smaller challenges and then gets completely taken out, and it's almost like a lorry going through Caniggia. But a gentle giant from what you experienced when you met him.
Yeah, I mean, he was such a lovely fella, because clearly you don't know what you expect when you've seen a video of somebody smashing an Argentinian up into the air 28 years ago. But I met him in just on the edge of the village where he was living, and he'd become a chief of his tribe, which I think essentially was a kind of local magistrate's role. Yeah. But I'd met him at a meeting of chiefs, and he had this long skirt on and a lion's tooth necklace. And a straw hat, so he was a sight to, you know, to behold even before it opened his mouth, and this huge man. But he spoke so wittily about it. You know, he had a kind of a twinkle in his eye, and he was saying, you know, if I had a penny for every time somebody had gone up to me and said, you know, you committed the best ever foul, I'd be a rich man. But he was interesting on, because he'd played in France, and he felt that he was sometimes victimised because he was, you know, an African footballer in Europe, and the fact he was just this massive bloke who clearly held a weight advantage over most forwards, yeah, acted against him. And I mean, one of the points which I spoke to one of the referees from that World Cup, Codesal Mendes, who was the final referee, he said that some of the referees were reluctant to officiate Cameroon's games, at least by the quarterfinal, because the Cameroonians were basically sending out a message that they were being victimised for the way they played the game, the fact they collected the most fouls of any team. Yeah. So there was a debate going on in that World Cup, and we laugh about it now, but at the time, you know, people were saying, are these boys going too far here?
Yeah. They obviously met England, who, as we said at the top, they had the best World Cup they had since 66, and they reached the semi-finals and are unfortunate to lose to that West Germany team. Obviously, like most England managers, Bobby Robson suffers at the hands of the media, but within the space of whatever, the space of that month and the short number of games they have there, how does the narrative change in terms of how the media deal with him? Because he's obviously passed away since, but by the end he was a respected figure. And much loved.
I mean, yeah, it's an incredible turnaround, really, as you say, in the space of a few weeks. Just to give you the background, England had an awful 88 Euro, you know, lost all three games. Robson was probably willing to resign at that point, carried on, took loads of abuse, especially, well, it reached a crescendo just before the World Cup because the FA weren't going to renew his contract, so he agrees to join PSV. For which he earns even more abuse, even though, you know, he wasn't being allowed to stay in his job with England. The World Cup begins with the game against the Irish, 1-1 kind of ball draw, really.
Yeah.
Which leads to even more criticism. The Sun newspaper I read in the British Library, I found, you know, what they were saying. They were asking Margaret Thatcher to send the boys home, you know, and spare us any more humiliation. So this is all building up and building up. The England players stopped talking to the press. And yet, you know, suddenly they start winning games, and they start winning games in the most dramatic, exciting way, without necessarily deserving to win them. But the fact, you know, you're on the edge of your seat, David Platt scores in the last minute of extra time against Belgium, then the Cameroon game. And, you know, suddenly England are in the first ever semi-final on foreign soil in a World Cup.
And for a nation like England, who I suppose hadn't had apart from 66, they hadn't had that track record of success. And then on one side, you put the standard of football not being the best, and maybe the results being good, but the actual performances not being glittering. In terms of marrying those two, is it a bit odd then that World Cup is so well remembered? Or is it just a question of a World Cup is always remembered the further you go, regardless of how well you perform. Because I think 1998, they actually played reasonably well from memory. And I think even 2002, there were some good performances before the David Seaman being chipped by Ronaldinho moment.
I mean, there's one thing we need to add here, which is Gaza, because yeah. I don't think perhaps no English player has ever played with that much freedom, you know, on the world stage yeah. before or since. I spoke to Brian Robson, and he made the point that you look at England teams over the last 15 years and they look afraid. They don't look like they're enjoying themselves. Whereas Gaza, you know, you'd have never thought that he was playing in a World Cup finals. There were just no nerves at all. For somebody who was 23 at the time, who'd not been, you know, he wasn't guaranteed a start. Even I think a game against the Czechoslovakia 2 months before the World Cup was yeah. when he cemented his place by setting up 3 goals, scoring one. So he kind of bursts into the scene, and he was one of the, you know, the forces of nature of that World Cup, mm-hmm. One of the true stars of it. And you know, I watched the semi final again, and even when he's had his, you know, his booking, and he's had his lip wobbling and the tears in his eyes, I mean, he's still, you know, picking up the ball and running at them. So I think Gascoigne is, we can't ignore, you know, what he meant.
Yeah, and we'll look at, I suppose, the effect of Gazamania in a short while as well, because there's other effects of that in terms of the long term impact of football, even more so the impact on him, which I think it's well documented. But switching to Ireland, who you mentioned played England and Kevin Sheedy's goal, which we were lucky enough to chat to Kevin on this show before, and obviously he features in your or he's mentioned in your book on Everton in the 80s, but the Ireland story, we forget that we didn't win any games in the 90 minutes because it doesn't really matter. We got to the quarterfinals and it was our first World Cup, second major tournament. It's a, you know, for us, it's a majorly, you know, a massive cultural significant moment, not just on a sporting level, but there are detractors, of course, and Eamon Dunphy, who is still a pundit here in Ireland and still, I suppose, his arguments are necessarily the same with regardless of which manager. Trapattoni was on the end of it, Martin O'Neill is on the end of it now, yet he goes to that World Cup and Colm Tobin then is along there with him and almost needs to be kind of keeping him away from the people who don't appreciate what he's saying.
Yeah, no, that's right. I spoke to Colm Tobin last summer and he was very kind of interesting in explaining to me just the extent of the kind of the anti-Dunphy sentiment that was raging around Ireland and what it was like for him. He had a call from his newspaper editor saying, you know, Eamon's coming over, will you keep an eye on him and keep an eye on the trouble? Because Dunphy went along to one of the press conferences and I think at that point Jack Charlton got up and walked out when Dunphy wanted to ask a question. But yeah, I mean, for me, you know, watching that World Cup on the other side of the water, it was new for me to discover the extent of the debate that was going on. I mean, other voices actually spoke out in support of Dunphy at the time. Hugh McIlvenny, you know, the respected Sunday Times writer for many years, he called it, he was sort of talking about a mongrel match between England and Ireland. So there were, you know, other people.
Yeah,
citing, you know, we've got a problem here, but yeah, Dunphy, Colm Tobin maybe summed it up nicely by saying, you know, the whole of Ireland's having an incredible party here. Why quibble about tactics?
Yeah, and to be honest, you know, it was obviously a moment of celebration. You can probably see where he's coming from in terms of the stylistic thing, but although that's a consistent gripe of his over a long period of time, but one that is understandable if you're maybe looking to develop a football culture that's going beyond just the results-driven side. One of the players he was pushing for inclusion was, of course, David O'Leary, a good ball-playing centre-back, and you know, the more recent ones have included Wes Hoolihan, who's obviously at Norwich and has retired from international football now, and before that he was pushing the case of Andy Reid. But yet, David O'Leary, who probably didn't have the best of relationships with Jack Charlton, he ends up becoming the hero, which is a lovely little ironic paradox.
No, yeah, very much so. I mean, the fact that he'd, you know, he'd been outcast really since the early days of Charlton's reign. I mean, looking into the background, he'd not wanted to join up with the friendly at the end of the season. So, you know, that really didn't help him. And I think it was nice. I rewatched the aftermatch interview he gave with George Hamilton. And he was saying, you know, I'm just pleased for my mum and dad. And you know, you could tell it's, you know, an incredibly special moment for him as well. I didn't speak to David for the book. I spoke to other players about it, and I mean, Kevin Sheedy took the credit for O'Leary's penalty taking technique, and then claimed that Jack Charlton took the credit wrongly. But Sheedy was saying that he told him, you know, make your mind up and just go. Pick your corner and go for it.
Yeah, and the other thing, I guess maybe it differs from the England camps in a way, but you were talking to Tony Cascarino, and there's this sense of, you wouldn't say it's very professional in terms of what goes on around it, but it actually worked for the Irish team. You know, Jack Charlton was happy for the players to go out for a drink, and it actually preferred the choice of alcohol to Coke, for example, and I mean Coca-Cola rather than anything else.
No, that's right. That was Tony Cascarino who told me, you know, Jack Charlton, in fact, before the Italy quarterfinal the night before, rather than have the players take sleeping pills, he said, you know, get a couple of Guinness down you.
And it worked.
It did. there's rights and wrongs with every time and every approach to things, but this definitely seemed to be a tightness among those groups of players then. Whether you agree that sportsmen bonding through alcohol is a good thing. They enjoy themselves, and there's that slightly lads on tour mentality. But it was the same with the England players. Obviously, they couldn't do it in quite as public a way because of the English press. But I mean, Terry Butcher told me some stories about, you know, breaking out from camp and, you know, having some beers. And even the interpreter I spoke to from the England camp was saying how, because there was an alcohol ban at the stadiums in the cities during Italia 90, he'd got hold of some beers for the squad after they beat Belgium in Bologna, and when he turns up on the bus with the beers, they're all chanting his name, and you know, this is the England football team. With the Ireland team, I mean, Cascarino made the point that England players like Dennis Wise would have said to him, you know, my one England cap's worth 50, you know, 50 Irish caps. So there's that self-importance maybe about the England team, possibly, which is given it by the English media. Whereas the Irish were a bit freer to just really let their hair down sometimes and have a bit of fun.
And we hadn't had that track record of success before, which probably differs a bit from England, who had a World Cup behind them. It's an interesting time in the world as well. Italia 90 falls through, so you've got the unification of Germany, which is completed after the tournament, and it's the last tournament for West Germany. Ceausescu's fallen in Romania. Then, you know, Czechoslovakia is breaking into two countries. Yugoslavia, in the space of the next decade, is split into six or seven countries at this point. And maybe to start off on Romania, so this is the team obviously that we beat in the second round, and Timofte misses the penalty, Paki Bonner saves it. It's one of our great moments over here. For Romania, the whole 80s period, Ceausescu had done a lot in terms of Romanian sport, and rugby is actually one of them, but soccer as well. The effects, I think, they were still felt for another two tournaments after that. But in a weird way, dictatorially, yes, a particularly nasty period for Romania. But in terms of the sporting side, certainly there's a benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to four or five of their team, and they evoked a real sense of something having been lost. Obviously, freedom, you know, is gained, but that whole state-sponsored system with sport brought success. You know, Steaua Bucharest, European Cup winners in 86, finalists again in 89. I think in 1989-90, Dynamo Bucharest reached one of the semi-finals of one of the other European competitions. So they were producing young players. They had good competitive teams on the European stage. And basically that was lost. And there was a vacuum that I don't think still hasn't been filled. Hadji's tried to fill it with, you know, the club he set up, who were Romanian champions last season. But really, you know, something's been missing ever since. I mean, they had some great stories about just life in their camp as well. And I don't want to diminish in any way Ireland's victory over them. But the idea I got from speaking to them was that they got out of the first round, and crucially, they'd all got their moves to the West. I mean, they were just, these were players without agents in their early 20s, And their hotel at the time was just full of, basically full of club directors,
yeah,
coming to negotiate contracts with them. Radu Choyu had the president of Anderlecht in his side of the room. Lupescu, his roommate, had Bayer Leverkusen's managing director next to him, you know, next to his bed. So all this was going on. So, I mean, they said to me, you know, if we'd only been 100% focused on the football, then we might have beaten Ireland. But yeah, clearly they weren't.
Yeah. All right, that was Simon Hart. So he wrote the book World in Motion about Italian 90. So there'll be more of that next week, part two of that interview, which goes into some of the other teams and narratives of the tournament. So that's it for this week's show. We'll be back with more on Friday, a couple of new faces as we did last week as well. So Derek Ryan, thanks for coming in.
No worries, Raf. Great
Joe
to be
Coffey.
Here. Raf will be in the midst, so thick of the final round, final group
yeah,
games
by
this time next week.
This time next week, yeah. So yeah. Looking forward to that anyway. We'll see who is on the precipice of entering into the next round.
England for Sam.
Okay, is that the final word?
That's the final word.
Take it away, Johan.